Welcome to Team GP Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP Membership Communities team. I'm Rebecca, and this is the second of our LGBT plus focused conversations for you this Pride Month, sharing perspectives on LGBT plus healthcare and Pride in practice. I'm delighted to have here three GPs who will be sharing their perspectives on this all-important area. Welcome everyone, and happy Pride Month. Let's start with some introductions.
Hello, good evening. My name's Adrian Harrop. I'm a GP in Liverpool. I work at a wonderful practice in Liverpool City Centre, where I serve a very complex and diverse metropolitan population. Utterly love it. Qualified in September of last year, so I'm a relative newbie to the field. Pretty into my LGBTQ activism, where a few people might know me from already, and really always looking to explore ways in which I can unite that side of my personality and things I enjoy along with my clinical work, which is one of the really exciting things about getting more and more involved with the LGBT activities at RCGP. So it's a real pleasure to be here this evening. Thank you.
I'm Rafiq. I'm a GP in London, down near Wimbledon. And I was listening to Adrian introducing himself and thinking that was probably me a few years ago. It's amazing how when you enter practice, things become difficult and you have the best intentions, but don't always deliver. And I was very much into LGBTQ rights previously. I think my big passion is education. I'm a trainer and a program director. For me, it's about, you know, making sure everyone's got the tools in their toolbox to help manage LGBT patients and make their lives as comfortable as possible in my just normal, everyday general practice.
And I'm James Bettridge-Sorby. I'm a GP in Swadlincote, which is in South Derbyshire. I'm a partner at the practice, and it's actually the practice that I was a registrar at, and also the practice that I was a patient at before I went to medical school. So I practice actually in my hometown. So I have a lot of connections with the place where I practice outside of medicine, as well as in the day job. I suppose for me, my main sort of interest in the LGBT health sphere lie within kind of equipping GPs, perhaps in more sort of semi-rural, less metropolitan areas where perhaps the number of LGBT patients isn't quite as high as some are in inner city areas, to make sure that the health experiences of the LGBT population and to a certain extent the lived experiences of LGBT health staff as well are equitable as they are with those in more metropolitan areas.
Well, one of the areas I've developed a bit of a special interest in over the last couple of years is the issue of transgender health. And this was an area that I was really looking to expand my expertise in when I was looking for my first post-qualification job, post-CCT job. And I sought out the practice I currently work at now as a real centre of excellence when it comes to how our practice manages and deals with the needs of the transgender community. We handle over, I think, 120 patients with a confirmed gender identity disorder of one type or another, or who identify as being transgender. And, you know, we look after possibly more trans patients than any other practice in the country, as far as I'm aware. And my practice allows me to explore that specialism and to do my specialist work with that community of people. And I've had a fantastic opportunity to really expand my skills and my experience of managing that community's very specialist and often very challenging needs. This has dovetailed quite nicely with a lot of the more political-based activism that I've been engaged with over the last couple of years, campaigning around transgender rights and transgender equality. This all kind of originates in activism that I undertook way back at university. I started university back in 2006, at which point I got quite engaged in the LGBT society at Manchester University, which, as you can imagine, was quite an exciting arena to be working in. And it was then really that I really got my eyes open to the challenges and difficulties that are faced by trans people just trying to go about having a normal life and engaging with normal mainstream society. It's such a challenging experience, and the things that we as cisgender people completely take for granted are often so challenging and so difficult for trans people. And having an opportunity as a doctor to deliver care to this community of people who are so marginalized and often neglected and overlooked, and being able to help that community achieve their goals and potential is a real privilege and something that I'm really, really happy to be involved with, and something I'm really proud to be involved with.
So I guess similar to Adrian, I started life coming out at university, went along to our local LGBT group at the time. And, you know, I think my background is from a Muslim background, quite a traditional background, and learning about, even today, I think the challenges of people coming out and feeling comfortable in their own skin and interacting with other people is an issue that I think hasn't gone away, however much we talk about gay rights. And so I went through quite a positive experience. I was very lucky, actually, ultimately, to have a family who were incredibly supportive, and I haven't really looked back. From that, I ended up joining the GLAAD, which is the Association of LGBTQ plus Doctors and Dentists in Britain. And over about a 15-year period, I spent about 5 years chairing GLAAD. And that brought me into contact with quite a few people. It was very interesting, one of which was the GMC, that was looking at the differing experiences of complaints against LGBT doctors and why those issues might be arising. I ended up becoming chair of the Equality Committee at the BMA to look at, again, equity and fairness, particularly from a staff perspective. And obviously my primary aim as a doctor is to improve the experience of the patients. What I learned from all of that is the importance of fellowship in each other. It's really interesting how when someone finds out someone's gay, for example, and one's gay oneself, there is a connection. And I think it would be wrong to say, oh, we're all the same, we're all, you know, open-minded. There is a genuine interest in other people and the journeys they've got, and feeling quite literally that one is not the only gay in the village, so to speak. So for me, it's actually quite important to provide safe spaces, communities, work groups where LGBTQ plus people can actually come together and support each other. And indeed, dare I say it, you know, for example, as a gay man, not every gay man is trans friendly. The two do not come together necessarily. And I've learned that. So for me, it was encouraging that movement. From all of that, then I went on to author the RCGP LGBT learning modules that I think have just been retired, replaced by a brilliant new suite. I'm about to have my latest two modules on trans health, particularly in adolescent health, are about to be released by the RCGP in the next few months. So I've had the privilege to learn how to sort of teach about these things and deliver lectures to medical schools. And it's, you know, another very interesting thing that came from GLAAD is a realization that how little we actually, at that time, certainly, and I don't think much has changed, do we talk about LGBT issues within medical school curricula or delivery of education in GP training, for example. So that's a real passion of mine, because I think they do need to be handled slightly differently, or at least have an awareness of what some of the issues might be. I don't think it's good enough to say, oh, well, I try to be open and fair to everyone. It's a bit more than that, that you do need to be wise to some of the specific health inequalities that exist and what you might do about.
I suppose for me, a slightly different path to Rafiq and Adrian. I didn't come out until I was 29. So I'd already kind of gone through sort of school, medical school, my GP training. And I remember in the sort of summer of 2014, I think it would have been, I remember going to about four or five weddings of sort of straight friends of mine. And it was kind of one of those sorts of moments, really, where kind of I thought to myself, do you know what, kind of, I've got my partnerships all lined up from September. I've kind of got to do this now, or potentially kind of I'm going to kind of continue sort of living in the closet, as it were, potentially for the rest of my life. I mean, I suppose kind of one of the things that influenced that, in the same way that Rafiq was talking about his sort of Muslim sort of faith background, I was brought up, you know, in a Christian household, not in a sort of anti-gay way, but just in a way that I was aware that sexuality was an issue for the church. And I think I'm a sort of natural kind of dove and peacemaker, that if something's an issue, it's just easier not to talk about it rather than confront it. So having sort of spoken to some other people in sort of faith communities that were out, I kind of resolved in my head that I could kind of make the Christian gay thing work, and then sort of came out, and I suppose kind of then sort of fell into some of the LGBT stuff by accident, in the sense that I'm kind of one of the only openly gay sort of GPs in my kind of patch. And in the same way that obs and gynae always seems to fall to the sort of female GPs in a practice, all the LGBT kind of queries come to the nominal gay GP in our area. And I think as well, kind of getting involved more with the sort of education side of things and thinking about sort of patient pathways, I suppose my experience made me kind of reflect, okay, what were the barriers? What were those sort of psychological factors that were preventing me from coming out when I was younger, and therefore kind of which members of my practice population might be thinking along similar lines as me? Because again, going back to Rafiq's point, you know, kind of there's a tendency to think that every gay man sort of wants to spend their life sort of, you know, kind of covered in glitter, sort of shouting from the rooftops, and you know, kind of we you know, obviously there's that huge sort of diversity kind of experience, and therefore kind of to be able to kind of advocate for anybody that's sort of having sort of questions, but also kind of share perhaps some of your own lived experience and say, do you know what, kind of actually it took me a while to work this all out as well. There's no hurry for you to kind of decide that you want to kind of you know, label yourself as something in particular and that's it sort of stuck with. So that's kind of how I sort of fell into it accidentally, sort of really. And I'd still sort of say that for me it's all an evolving kind of learning process still, but if I can share that learning process with my patients and point out that it's okay still to be learning, or equally for their family members that, you know, might be finding that this is a new situation to them and their family that they've not considered before, I think that can be helpful to do a bit of sort of hand holding with patients sometimes, as much as actually being there as somebody to give instruction.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear what James was just saying there about effectively providing an inclusive, supportive and affirming space for our patients, giving them an opportunity to share a moment and a space with a doctor who really does understand where they're coming from. This is something that I've only really gained much more insight into since I've started my my work post-CCT, is that often patients will come into this space having identified me as an openly gay doctor, as someone who does do a lot of active public work with the LGBTQ community, and will come in and share the most private and intimate details about what's going on inside their own head, about things that they've been dwelling on or contemplating or trying to deal with, often for many, many years. Often in my experience, this will be students who are quite newly arrived at the university in Liverpool, because that's one of the communities we serve, and giving them an opportunity to share that moment, to share that space with a doctor who really understands the experience that they're going through, That's such a powerful tool that we've got, and something that I think is something we really need to cherish and embrace, the fact that as LGBTQ advocates and as doctors, we can create that environment where people can feel safe to share those very, very difficult issues and those very, very challenging problems that they're trying to deal with and overcome as part of that coming out journey. And I think it's interesting to hear James's experience of coming to that much later on in life than I did personally. You know, I grew up in a very non-religious, very, very liberal kind of household. I was out and proud at age 15 at school. Do you know what I mean? It was that kind of environment I grew up in. And it's interesting to hear how people have approached this part of their life in different ways and how that can bring different experiences that we can all call upon and all use to help our own individual patient groups. It's really interesting. Yeah.
I think what James said really I found so powerful just now. I was thinking a bit about a few things. Firstly, how, you know, I'm slightly older than James and Adrian, not much, but enough that when I started my journey, the word queer wasn't necessarily entirely positive as a word. It didn't really mean anything as an identity quite how it does now. And I think what I've learned is that, you know, language evolves, but also my own attitudes need to change occasionally, because when I first heard the word queer, I didn't like it. And now I've kind of embraced it, and how these things, you know, just because I'm LGBTQ or whatever, or self-identifying as gay, doesn't mean I'm an expert in any of this. And I could make mistakes. I might not understand other people, and each person's journey is going to be different. That's one thing it made me think of. I think the other thing is, you know, I think, and I'm sorry if it's a generalization, but the younger generation going through school now, for example, have been told, you know, you should be out and proud. You shouldn't have any problems. You shouldn't tolerate discrimination. You know, they're taught to be quite vocal and forthright about that. The trouble with that is that's fine if you have already gone on the journey of coming out to yourself, that where there isn't so much cognitive dissonance going on inside you. But we're all, you know, most people will be on a journey. Some people do that journey within 5 minutes. Others might take a few years. And it's very important, I think, to support someone in saying it's actually okay that you aren't out and proud. That actually if someone says something like, you know, I'll give an example in the playground, that's so gay, you know, and of course you hear that all the time, that they might not feel comfortable to challenge, and that's absolutely fine as well. There's a tendency to say, oh, we've all got to be kind of pushing an agenda, and that can be quite difficult if you haven't yet gained your skills and may never be comfortable for you to do. So there were some of the thoughts I had about welcoming someone on the different parts of their journey. That can go in and out at any one time. Sometimes I'm confident as a gay man. Other times I actually sit back and you know, let things happen that perhaps I ought not to. But as long as I'm comfortable with that, that's the most important thing.
It's really interesting that Rafiq brings up the sort of experience that sort of school children sort of go through today, and the sort of obviously much more, you know, kind of inclusive education that they have. Because I agree with him, sometimes you almost kind of feel that it's so, that children are sort of presented with sort of so many options of what they could be and how they could label themselves, that almost sort of they're in a kind of a hurry to reach that conclusion far too quickly. And I know I've certainly had a number of consultations in the past with sort of worried parents who have brought, for example, you know, sort of a 14, 15 year old boy who's not at all into sports, very into kind of sort of poetry and kind of classical music, and, you know, kind of enjoys dance at school. And he's made a leap that, you know, kind of he is therefore inhabiting the wrong sort of gendered body. And therefore they've come to me and read that they need a referral to, you know, kind of a gender identity clinic. That's worrying enough in itself. But the thing that worries me the most is I've got GP colleagues in my area who, on hearing that story, make that referral, I almost kind of think part of the sort of education process with all of this for the kind of healthcare professionals and sort of people working in primary care is to kind of almost improve their own sort of get a better understanding of kind of what the sort of issues are, because as ever with any kind of secondary care sort of service, generally kind of one of the things that adds into delays and prevents the right people getting the right care is the fact that there's a lot of wrong people referred into a service. And when we know kind of trans people, you know, kind of spend so long waiting for appropriate care, I do wonder to what extent that's not helped by kind of having quite poorly informed people making sort of initial referrals at time. But I'm sure that's something that Adrian's in a far better place to pick up on than I am.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point you've just made there, James, about the number of people, the number of young people and children who get referred into gender identity services almost entirely inappropriately, in that, you know, often these are children who are displaying gender non-conforming behaviours, is the way that one might say it, or behaviours that might be more characteristic of a child who will at some stage in the future grow up to be a lesbian or gay child, or gay adult rather. And I think that often that comes from often GPs not having the confidence to acknowledge that and to recognize that for what it is, and to say that, you know what, we live in an environment, we live in a world where people can enjoy and engage in various different things that don't meet those very gender conforming roles that people have got set up for them in society, that, you know, there's no such thing as these things are what boys do, these things are what girls do, etc., etc. It's just not true any longer. And I think that it kind of, it's two sides of the same coin, really, in that we want to create a space and create a world in which children and young people can grow up to be whatever they need to be, or to realize their full potential, or be whoever they are without feeling oppressed or marginalized or othered or made to feel that they're strange and unusual in any way. You want to create an environment where children can develop and grow up in whatever way they need to. Whereas at the same time, what you don't want to do is to see that children who perhaps don't sit with very neatly within those boxes and within those boundaries being pathologized or medicalized and being brought to the doctor for further assessment and treatment. And I think it's a big learning curve that society is going through right now, in that I think that the younger generation have probably got a lot to teach us, in that, you know, the younger generation, when you speak to typical teenagers who are currently going through high school now, they're often so much more broad-minded and accepting of people who sit somewhere on the LGBTQ spectrum, or people who are gender non-conforming, or people who are trans or genderqueer or whatever else. You know, people are generally much more open-minded now, even more so than our generation is. So, you know, as speaking as, you know, cisgendered gay men in our 30s, you know, we obviously have a relatively narrow perspective on this, but the younger generation are generally so much more broad and open-minded to this than our generation is. And it's something that we're continuing to learn more and more about as time goes on.
I'll just quickly respond to that, Adrian, by saying that in my experience of teaching, you know, it's still a bit mind-blowing, the concept of someone not being in a binary gender. You know, I actually have to admit, I find it difficult. I have to remind myself, you know, to think about gender neutral pronouns, to respect how the person wants to be identified, because I find I slip into the he, she quite easily because I've been conditioned to do that. It takes practice, but it also takes an apology if you get it wrong. And that normally that's quickly dealt with. And the patient actually appreciates that you're not perfect. But I think being comfortable with that and saying from the outset how much you still care about them, and, you know, if you get something wrong, let me know I've got something wrong. It's so important. But being open to the fact that someone might be not, you know, male, female in its, you know, in the traditional sense of the word, is such a challenge.
I think that is so, so important. The description I've heard given to it is leaning into the discomfort. is in a way exploring those areas and those arenas in which you don't feel comfortable, which do challenge your preconceptions and these, you know, preconceived ideas you have about gender or sexuality, and exploring that. Why is it that your framing and your mindset around these things has been set in a particular way? And in what ways can we challenge that and expand our ideas and learn more in order to create spaces for our patients where they feel safe and affirmed and can feel that they can open up to us as their doctors?
I suppose just two quick points to follow up on that, really. One of the things that always I rate people in the church that I speak to, because obviously kind of the church has its own battle with how that as an organisation deals with LGBT issues, is I always say to people in church, when I say to a patient that I'm a Christian gay doctor, it's the Christian bit that takes the most explanation, not the gay bit, as if to understand, you know, kind of from a society point of view, having a faith is deemed a lot more peculiar these days than identifying as LGBT plus. The other thing as well, just going back to kind of sort of dealing with kind of young people and terminology and things, I remember when I made a gender identity clinic referral once for a 14-year-old, the actual sort of power of when, you know, sort of first of all, kind of having a decent length of consultation, you know, these are not consultations that you can do in 10 minutes, so don't pretend to, you know, kind of set a proper amount of time aside for them. But I remember kind of going through sort of what I was going to put in the referral, having the discussion with the patient as to what pronouns they wanted to use, what name they wanted to use, doing all of this in front of the parents. And because I'd been their sort of family GP for 4 or 5 years, suddenly the way that I was approaching this was giving a lot of validity to kind of the stuff that the parents had perhaps sort of read on a website but didn't know whether to trust or not. And I think that's a really important part for the GP in this, because not only do we look after the patient, but certainly with our younger, you know, sort of patients, we're obviously looking after family members, parents, grandparents, that are all going to be affected by this ongoing situation. And sometimes I kind of feel it's my role to kind of almost, you know, sort of set the standard, set the way of kind of what an acceptable way of doing this is. But equally, kind of hopefully, as a result of me doing that, they will see that that has a degree more validity than just sort of reading that that's the way it's done on a relatively anonymous.
Every component, every division of the LGBTQ community faces its own inequalities and health disparities compared to the cisgendered heterosexual population. I mean, every study you can look at shows that, generally speaking, LGBTQ patients of whatever description do suffer worse health outcomes compared to their cisgendered heterosexual counterparts, be that from a sexual health perspective, be that from a patient's accessing screening tests such as cervical smear tests and things like that, be that from an accessing healthcare full stop as a transgender patient. That's the area, you know, of course, I have my own personal experience with doing my work here in Liverpool, is that very often trans patients won't come to the doctor at all because they feel that their identity is so neglected and disrespected and not acknowledged by virtually anybody within the public sphere, especially with from their own family doctor. And they feel that coming to the doctor and having to present themselves in such a way and not having their identity affirmed can be a really dehumanizing and invalidating experience for them, be that whether they're presenting with a cough and a cold, be that to do with a gender identity issue that they need assistance and help with, or be that presenting with really serious features that could be indicative of an undiagnosed cancer or something like that. We know that trans patients really do suffer from that point of view. And I think as primary care practitioners, we do have a really central role in building on that and in dealing with that situation and in helping this very marginalised, very vulnerable community, and helping them to seek out the primary healthcare services that they need. And there's many, many ways in which we can do that, be that as simple as being prepared to address that person by their chosen name, by their real name, That is one of the major things we can do by addressing them with the correct pronouns, by making sure that when they come to the doctor with any issue whatsoever, they're not going to face this deep scrutiny about every aspect of their gender identity, such as what happens often when trans patients access any type of healthcare services. There's a phenomenon that people might have heard of if you've engaged in any of these conversations about the trans broken arm syndrome, about patients coming in with a completely unrelated healthcare problem, facing all kinds of scrutiny and assessment about their gender identity when it simply is not relevant to the specific consultation they're attending for. There's so many aspects to the ways in which the care of trans patients could be improved in the primary care sector. And I think I come at this from a bit of a unique perspective in that I work in a practice where we have a critical mass of patients who, you know, that gives us the expertise and the familiarity with dealing with these patients and the issues that they face on a day-to-day basis that many GPs in virtually every other setting and every other practice around the country simply wouldn't deal with people of that kind of scale, being that in the vast majority of GP practices, most practices may only have one, two, maybe half a dozen transgender patients on their books at any one time, whereas in my particular setting we have over 100, which is a completely different ball game and gives us a certain insight and expertise that perhaps is lacking elsewhere in many cases. And this is something that I'm hoping that the work that I'm getting more and more involved with now with the LGBT activities at RCGP will allow us to spread this knowledge and spread this expertise and enable GPs who work in more isolated, rural, non-urban settings, such as where James works or in any other place around the country, give them the skills they need to help address these health inequalities and to improve the situation that many trans people in this country still face, which is, you know, a huge project and a huge amount of work, but something I'm really, really excited about getting involved with.
I think the first and most important thing is obviously that getting someone through the door to actually have a conversation with their healthcare professional. And sadly, the reality is there is still a barrier, whether perceived or real, that is experienced by patients every day in Britain. Adrian's talked about the trans sort of phobic things that can happen, but it can happen just so subtly. If you think that your doctor might not share your values, it can mean that you won't share your story. Subtle things. I know we're individuals and we want to portray who we are as doctors, and that's important too for trust with our patients. You know, patients like to know who they're dealing with, yeah, and that you might have some shared viewpoints. But equally, that can be quite a double-edged sword. So an example would be going into a room covered with photos of your five children and a cross on the wall, and you know, other clues that could play to someone's own prejudice. Now, I know that everyone should stop being prejudiced. I know that. It's obviously important that the patient is challenged too. But ultimately, if they're at a time where they're vulnerable in their lives, they kind of need to be able to open up. So that's one big issue. Another big issue is seeing their sexual orientation or on that spectrum as being relevant to the consultation. So a lot of the times, if the GP is ignorant of how it could be relevant, they might not ask the question. And an assumption would be made that they're cisgendered or that they're straight. And that can further exacerbate health inequalities. So the doctors do need to know their stuff, need to ask the question and explain its relevance. And that's a very important thing that Adrian just talked about. You know, it has to be relevant to that consultation as to why I want to know that you, whether you've had sex with men or you know whatever. So I think that's a big issue of people not actually appreciating how relevant it is. And one of the reasons that it doesn't come up as much is the dearth of research. So if you want to know for me what affects me day to day in my practice, is that I don't know for fact all the health inequalities exist because no research is really being done. There's no money in it and there's not enough you know, it's very hard to define research questions when you have such a variety of people who want to, who don't want to be necessarily pigeonholed as gay, for example. You know, what does that mean, you know, to that individual? So there are real challenges with research, but we already know there are some behavioral things that are different that might be to do with societal stress around smoking and drinking are definitely issues for most of the populations that we're talking about today. But we know, for example, that there are, we're beginning to think, sorry, that, that there are cancer differences. And we don't fully understand why. We think it's more than just a confounder. There is something a little bit different going on, and we need to do that research. So I think one of the problems is that, you know, you've got very powerful lobby groups for, you know, Cancer Research UK, you know, British Heart Foundation, you've got all these different groups that will lobby to improve the care for patients. But actually it's quite difficult to do that for LGBTQ plus people because we don't actually have that data in the first place. And that's partly to do with coding. It's one of my big bugbears is that the only way we're going to get, you know, research that works is if we can use things like the primary care data. We've got massively rich data source, but the one thing we don't record, or even really are trying to properly record, are the LGBTQ plus status of patients. Now, that is challenging. I don't want to belittle how challenging. I've been in committee meetings at NHS England just to talk about how, what words we use that don't offend people. But ultimately, if we don't start asking the question, coding it, and then seeing what patterns are emerging, we are never going to progress these issues for our patients. So that's my big one. I think in COVID, that's made me very mindful of social isolation. Now, I don't want anyone to go away thinking, woe is me, all LGBTQ plus people must be lonely and depressed. That's not the world that we live in. You know, I'm happily married to my husband, you know, and life is fantastic for me. But it is, I think, a fact that for a certain number of people, they haven't necessarily got the wider social networks. You know, because people who have transitioned have sometimes had to leave their entire previous lives behind and the support that they had. You know, similarly for gay people. So I think there's that. And also, you know, the pressures of living in cities. Naturally, LGBT people move to cities, often without a social network, so they can feel they can lead their life more liberally in a, with the anonymity of the city. But with the city living can come, obviously, that degree of loneliness and lack of the proper support. And I think in COVID, we're certainly seeing that. I've certainly been aware of patients saying, you know, I've lost my friendship group where I would go to the bar with them once a week, and that was my family, essentially, here, and I don't have that at the moment. So if you do come across that, it's worth anticipating. I just double checking with the person, but they might be very happy. Please don't assume that everyone's miserable either.
I suppose from my point of view, I kind of probably think about it whenever I've been the patient, perhaps as well, rather than the sort of doctor. So, I mean, I've certainly been to both hospital outpatient appointments and GP appointments whereby I've walked in with my husband in the same way that lots of husbands walk in with their wives. Often you kind of see the sort of, there's a funny look on the face of the clinician thinking, you're a grown man, why is another grown man coming with you? Then their sort of face rearranges as if to kind of say, oh, that might be why. Goodness me, what did my face say the first time? Do I need to kind of sort of apologize and explain sort of all of this? So that's always a little bit awkward, and it's an awkwardness that isn't there if you are a straight person going in with their opposite gendered sort of partner or spouse. So that's at the off. Again, sort of from sort of what sort of Rafiq was saying as well, we need patients to kind of realize that actually there are huge kind of benefits from a health from a public health promotion point of view of us as GPs knowing what their sexual orientation and their sort of gender identity is. again, another example from my point of view, I know that as a man, a gay man that's aged between 18 and 45, I'm entitled to have a HPV vaccine. Now, I know that because I'm a GP who's interested in LGBT health. At no point in time has any health professional, such as my GP, ever said to me, did you know you are entitled to this vaccine? And as a result of that, you know, kind of short of me kind of periodically putting things on my sort of social, on the social media pages of my surgery, reminding kind of my practice population that this is available to them, I have no way of sort of enabling that kind of health promotion work to go ahead. Now, you know, kind of if the onus was on a woman to kind of book her own mammogram to prevent her getting breast cancer, there would be, you know, kind of outcry. Yet this is deemed to be kind of acceptable in the sort of LGBT health sphere at present. So there needs to be kind of a lot more joining up of the dots. I suppose the third thing I'd say, kind of, and this is from my experience as a GP, my practice is one whereby we take out of area registration. So kind of you don't need to live within our practice area to register at our practice. And I've had a couple of trans patients from an adjoining county who have come and registered at my practice purely because myself and our practice nurses are more than happy to take part in the shared care arrangements for injections that are done in the community at the behest and under the sort of remote supervision of the gender identity clinic. Now, again, that's awful that there is a county whereby their sort of CCG stroke, you know, kind of LMC have adopted a position whereby the solution for this is to get patients to register with a GP outside of their county that's prepared to do them, prepared to support this shared care work. Whereas I work on the principle, again, that, you know, if you're prepared to do shared care for rheumatoid arthritis with injections, you ought to be prepared to do shared care for patients that are going to a gender identity service. So it's all of those sort of little bits of inequality that kind of we face day to day. But the annoying thing is that it's the same issues that keep coming up time and time again. And hopefully with this work, there'll be a generation of GPs coming through that not only are at the forefront of this work, but are also going to be the people on the committees that kind of make these decisions in the future that say, hang on a minute, this is completely unreasonable. Of course, we're not going to do that.
And I think the RCGP position, it could be a bit more positive in my own personal view, but I actually still respect it, which is, you know, do what you feel competent to do, but don't say, I don't know anything about it, so I won't do it. Just like if you didn't know anything about secondary hyperparathyroidism, you might try and look it up. Equally, I'd expect you to look up anything else to do with trans care. And there are plenty of resources out there on the RCGP website now. There's e-learning modules. There's stuff from the GIC clinics themselves to explain how to monitor the hormones. And we're talking about simply doing a blood test and making sure patients are aware of the risks. It's not any different to any other treatment.
It just is completely unfair and totally indefensible, if you ask me. The idea that treatment, which is relatively straightforward, relatively basic stuff, you know, giving these injectable hormones and hormone supplements, hormone patches, whatever else, this is not greatly different than the treatment we give cisgender women who need HRT or men who need prostate injections for prostate cancer. These are the same drugs that we use day to day for many, many other indications that are not greatly expensive, they're not greatly complicated, the monitoring is not that difficult for them. These are straightforward, basic bits of medicine that we should have the best familiarity with as GPs. This is our bread and butter. And people, I think, are using, you know, the fact that it's a complex secondary care issue just simply as an excuse because they don't want to get involved with this, be that for funding reasons, be that for their own personal ethical reasons or whatever else. But as far as I'm concerned, it's just utter nonsense and really just shouldn't be happening. The idea that any other group of patients would be forced to travel across the country, often many hundreds of miles away from where they live, to access what are basic blood tests and basic care and basic interventions, it's just ludicrous. It's obscenely expensive. expensive, obscenely time-consuming, and just completely unfair. And no other group of patients would have to face this without people being in absolute uproar about it. I mean, in terms of the waiting times are obscenely long and shockingly long, even for doctors who are familiar with services that have lengthy waiting periods, bearing in mind that, you know, many of the GICs now, I believe that one of them down in London, I can't remember exactly which one, is currently doing their first consultation, the first appointment, not the second or third, the first consultation for patients who were referred in September 2017. Okay, so that's almost 3 years ago, doing a first consultation. And that's just entirely unacceptable, especially when you consider the fact that that is 3 years, nearly 3 years, after a GP has made a referral. At which point, you know, that patient may well have spent 5, 10, 50, 20 years building up the confidence to come to their GP to out themselves as being trans and to say, look, this is who I am, this is my identity, I need help with this, I need to be referred to a gender identity clinic. And then once they get to the gender identity clinic, they now have to go through so many hurdles of psychotherapeutic assessment over months and years, often waiting 2, 3, 4, 5 years before they're able to access this basic hormone treatment. And it's entirely unacceptable. And in terms of what Rafiq was saying about having solutions to this problem, it's actually really interesting you'll bring this up, because I actually had a really interesting conversation about this just yesterday, in that here in Liverpool, we have a great system here. You know, a lot of our GPs, our LMC, our CCGs are all very much on board with the treatment of trans people. And, you know, our trans patients, I think, here get a better deal than they do in most other locations around the country. We're actually in the process of setting up a primary care pilot program for a new model of a gender identity service. Ours is called Sea Magic, and there are other ones that are setting up in Manchester and in London. The 56 Dean Street Clinic is setting up the one in London. And these are systems and services that are going to really try and hammer down those huge waiting lists that are in existence for the secondary care gender identity services. And hopefully, over the next few years, a new type of gender identity clinic will evolve from that is much more primary care led and is led from the communities that it's set up in. And that's the vision that we've got here in Liverpool. And it's something that I'm really, really excited to be involved with. And hopefully we should see some positive change and some progress being made. Because as Rafiq and as James was saying just a few minutes ago, you know, the system that we've got at the moment for trans patients is just simply not fit for purpose. And it just isn't a system that's befitting of, you know, the fifth richest nation on earth in a Western progressive society. We really shouldn't be treating some of our most vulnerable and marginalized citizens in this way, because it's just wrong. It's just despicable and wrong.
The RCGP LGBT Plus steering groups made great progress this year, including the new LGBT Plus e-learning hub, Pride events, and much more. So I guess the question is, what is next? What would you all like to see from the college over the next few years?
So I'm really proud of what we've managed to do so far. Largely with the output of the work stream, but also actually proud of the college that they have actually valued that this is a worthwhile use of sort of college time. Because I know certainly for me, as I mentioned at the beginning of this, as somebody that's, you know, kind of relatively sort of late to the LGBT party in terms of coming out, it actually kind of affirms for me that kind of my professional kind of body is concerned about kind of what, you know, kind of took me a long time to sort out in my own head. So I'm really proud of the college in that respect. I think there's a major role for kind of education, and I'm really kind of keen that kind of we begin to see kind of LGBT health cases featuring in the CSA for when we return to a CSA in a non-COVID sort of era, and really sort of let this become sort of bread and butter kind of part of the curriculum, like other aspects of healthcare are as well. I think there's an advocacy role potentially, perhaps lying more with the sort of deaneries within the RCGP, whether kind of they adopt a model of sort of having a sort of LGBT kind of champion in each deanery, something along those lines that can perhaps be a spokesperson and sort of focal point for kind of advice for different sort of geographical areas. That's a model that I've thought might work, particularly in areas such as mine, whereby the volume of sort of work that potentially people are seeing is not enough for perhaps sort of an individual GP to feel they're constantly kind of at the top of their game. And in the same way that we have, you know, sort of GPs that, you know, kind of act as leads over wider areas and resources for, you know, kind of other areas of healthcare, perhaps that's something that we can begin to develop. I think as well, there's also a thing about kind of helping to kind of raise the profile of sort of people from the LGBT plus community that are working within the healthcare sort of sector as well. For me, that does two things. One, it celebrates the diversity of our workforce, but it also says to the public, yes, this person is gay, yes, this person is lesbian, yes, this person is transgender, but more importantly, they're the person that kind of helps you when you're bereaved. They're the person that kind of, you know, delivered your baby. And actually kind of for particularly people that don't have, you know, kind of perhaps many kind of gay friends or sort of any experience of sort of LGBT plus people in their own sort of friendship circles or family circles, kind of help sort of normalize the sort of different parts of society and the diversity of society, rather in the same way that kind of soaps have, I suppose, that kind of it's no longer an abnormal thing to have an LGBT plus character in a soap opera. Hopefully kind of for the kids growing up, you know, kind of, yes, I'd like them to think, oh, I had a doctor that was gay. But more importantly, I'd like to think I had a great doctor and he was gay. Yeah. And I think that's kind of where we can help, particularly kind of as people who are still, you know, kind of viewed as trusted members of society, that society by and large still kind of look up to.
I came to the sort of table a bit later when the group had sort of already had a few meetings. But what I found amazing was how welcomed I was. I think the main purpose of having us as one of the community groups is exactly that, to build a community. And, you know, however confident and however kind of socialized we are in our private lives and everything else, it is so refreshing to be able to be a professional GP and have that LGBTQ hat on. And, you know, I've been yearning for that, really. And I'm really proud, again, I share James' feelings that I'm proud of college that has understood the importance of fellowship in other people. You know, it actually can be quite hard if you're someone like Adrian, I imagine, who, you know, shouts from the rooftops for trans rights. That gets quite tiring sometimes. And it's nice to be able to sense check what you're saying with your colleagues, but also then know they can back you up a bit. And I think that's quite important. It can be quite hard to be an advocate on your own. And with that strength, actually, one of the roles I have that I didn't mention was that I am the co-chair of Wonka's LGBT special interest group. So just like they have this group, they have one at the World GP Organization. And what I, of course, you can imagine I see is a real variation with how LGBT-friendly different societies are and their health systems are. And I'm not saying we're the best, and I wouldn't want to push my values or our values in Britain on other people. But I think we do have a role if we can help push those agendas forward for the world's population. You know, people have to do that, and I think people do look to us. I think they've looked to our e-learning modules, for example, which I'm very pleased to say that the government department that helped pay for that has said, yeah, spread them widely. You know, they've been paid for, and that's the sort of thing we should be doing if they can be of some use or application to other people. So for me, you know, the group has been great. I also think it's actually another thing we don't do enough is have fun. You know, I know it sounds a bit stupid, but one of the most refreshing things I found, I've been on, half a dozen college committees over the years. I've been very involved, and you might have fun over a bit of alcohol. Well, that's one thing, networking. But actually, as another, actually having joy and going on things like pride marches, I think these meetings are the ones I probably smiled in the most. And I don't know people brilliantly well yet, but I already know I've got friends for life, I think, from the group.
Just to wrap up now, Pride is personal. What does Pride mean to you, and how have you celebrated, or how are you going to celebrate this year?
Well, Pride is a very, very important time of year for me. It's an occasion, an event, a celebration when I get to stand in solidarity with the rest of my community out on the streets, being visible, being loud, being proud, and really cheering and celebrating what makes our community so beautiful and so diverse and so special, and uplifting those things that we can achieve when we work together and when we collaborate and stand in solidarity with one another. And it's been a real interesting point of reflection this year, in that with the COVID-19 pandemic, regrettably, we haven't been able to unite together and march in the streets as we have done for so many years up until now. And that has been a real loss to me and to many activists within this community and within this movement. And we've had to reflect on what are our goals and what are we trying to achieve and what is the desired outcome from this and what is important. Is marching down the street in a rainbow coloured costume and cheering and dancing, is that the important bit? And whilst that's fun and whilst that's really good and fantastic and something we should celebrate, that isn't what this has ever been about, really. What this is about is about standing with each other, fighting together, fighting alongside each other for that recognition, for that equality, for that recognition in law and that protection in law that we all need and we all deserve as human beings. And that's something that we will continue to fight for and something we need to continue to fight for, both as doctors here at RCGP, as citizens within this society, until all of our LGBTQ brothers, sisters and siblings can say that they have achieved freedom and equality. And I'm sad to say we are quite a way away from that, even at this point. And that's something that we all really need to keep fighting for. I'm hoping that next year we'll be able to gather together and march in the streets and dance and sing and celebrate the way that we have done in years gone by. But even if we're not able to do that for a while yet, we do still all need to remember what we're actually fighting for, and the fact that Pride is a protest and Pride is about fighting for our rights and for our legal equality. And that's something we should never give up fighting.
Pride for me is all the things Adrian said, but also remembering that not everyone is as fortunate as we are here in Britain. For me, I use it as an opportunity to reach out internationally to people. In my role through Wonka, I have been approached by GPs in certain countries where they cannot actually be gay. They've had to use secure means of communicating with me because people are monitoring their emails and they'll end up in prison or even killed should they be gay in their own societies. So I find it a sobering time, but a time where I hope us being visible, for me, the visibility is about other people around the world seeing that, that there is hope, that it can get better. It gets better. That campaign is so very true. So for me, that's it. And I separate that out from the fact that I actually just sometimes do need a bit of fun and fellowship again with my colleagues. And, there is something quite incredible about the energy you get when you're walking down the street in a Pride march and you see thousands of people smiling back at you. That doesn't happen very often. It's actually one of the privileges I have of being gay. You know, most of the time when people march, they're angry. Now, I'm not saying I am angry deep down, but I put on a smile, and getting all that biofeedback from people to say, you know, we're with you and we also, you know, want you to have fun and you to be happy. I mean, that is so, so powerful. It's such an endorphin rush, and it's quite nice to have that once a year or so. And I was, I think the RCGP marching in Pride and seeing, you know, its last chair being part of that process, I think also help people understand that being gay isn't always a negative thing. And we have a lot of advantages too. And we just need sometimes to be reminded of that. And that for me is what Pride can do.
Huge thanks to our guests this week. What a lovely way to end the show. Check out the episode notes below to follow their work, as well as links to RCGP LGBT Plus Health Hub and other resources mentioned in the episode. If you're enjoying these conversations, then share them with a friend or tweet us at Team GP. But that's all for now. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.